Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 22, 30 verses. In this chapter, the chapter discusses various laws, miscellaneous laws, and also laws concerning sexual immorality. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Deuteronomy 21, we looked at laws concerning atonement for unsolved murders, laws for marrying female slaves, laws preserving the firstborn of an unloved wife, laws concerning what to do with rebellious sons, laws with what to do with a man hanged on a tree overnight. Again, miscellaneous legal matters, and we'll still look at it, miscellaneous legal matters in Deuteronomy 22. So we start now in Deuteronomy 22, verses 1 through 4. You shall not see your countryman's ox or his sheep straying away and paying no attention to them. You shall certainly bring them back to your countrymen. If your countryman is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it home to your house, and it shall remain with you until your countryman looks for it. Then you shall restore it to him. Thus you shall do with his donkey, and you shall do the same with his garment, and you shall do likewise with anything lost by your countryman, which he has lost, and you have found. You are not allowed to neglect them. You shall not see your countryman's donkey or his ox fallen down on the way, and pay no attention to them. You shall certainly help him to raise them up. Now, these four verses are the perfect answer to that false legal dictum, finders keepers, losers weepers. That is not in the law, not in the American, not in the English common law, and not in the ancient Jewish law. Someone who finds lost property becomes a bailor of that property and is charged with the law in keeping it without negligence until the true owner is found. And that's the same as the law here in Deuteronomy 22. The NIV Study Bible points out that this law illustrates another aspect of the law besides property, besides a criminal behavior, the fact that the law actively promotes somebody else's well-being. It just doesn't protect people from other people hurting them. This is a case where somebody is supposed to affirmatively help someone else who has a problem. And notice this includes enemies as well as friends. We read in Exodus 23, 4 through 5. If you come across your enemy's stray ox or donkey, you must return it to him, your enemies, not just your friends. Verse 5, Exodus 23. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you lying helpless under its load and you want to refrain from helping it, you must help with it. You got to help your enemies as well as your friends. Love your enemies as yourself. Now, an ox wandering around loose, that's a relatively small thing, but it illustrates a larger principle, as Adam Clark points out. It shows that the Israelite should have care for others and others' property in general, not just with lost animals. Now, note that the main purpose of this law was not the prevention of cruelty to animals. It was for the promotion of goodness to humans, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. John Gillis, we see, sees whenever there's some law that has to do with animals being protected, he always says it's to prevent cruelty to animals. He must have a soft spot for animals. But I don't think that's mainly what these laws are that help animals out. There's other rationales behind them, although sometimes it could be to, as an object lesson, to show that we don't harm animals, because to harm animals, if you don't harm an animal, a fortiori, you don't harm human beings. You're supposed to show love to your fellow human beings. We go down to verse 5, Deuteronomy 22. A woman shall not wear man's clothing, nor shall a man put on a woman's clothing, for whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God. Now, the purpose of this law was to stop sexual perversions, examples transvestism, homosexuality, and this would especially be true if the transvestism or homosexuality occurred under religious auspices, as the NIV Study Bible says. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown thinks that, however, most of the crimes that are contemplated here are done mostly in common life, not in connection with religious worship. Now, we need to be careful here. Not wear man's clothing or woman's clothing. That's in their culture. I mean, if you wanted to be absolute about it, you could say, well, a Scottish man is wearing a woman's clothing because he's wearing a skirt. Well, not in the Scottish culture. A kilt is not considered a woman's clothing in Scottish culture. So a Scots man is not wearing a woman's clothing when he wears a skirt. Likewise, women wearing pantsuits in modern American culture, that does not mean they're trying to act like a man or look like a man. Now, I know this, and I knew this when I had a date with one liberated Campus Crusade for Christ Christian at my university, University of South Carolina, and I quoted this verse to her because she liked to wear pants. I was just trying to bug her because she was a little bit cocky, a little bit feisty, a little bit cocky. Well, she thought I was serious. Oh, she was upset about that. I thought I'd never hear the end of it. Not only from her that night, because that was the last date I ever had with her. I'm sure she would have nothing more to do with me after that. But I will say, though, she ended up being a Buddhist, and a good friend of mine saw her in a bar one night drunk out of her mind, and she's completely backslidden. So maybe if she'd have worn a dress all the time, she wouldn't have gotten herself in that awful spiritual state. I'm joking again. Now, not only is it transvestism, let me give you an example. There was a basketball player in my class at a college I was teaching. He was one of the starters and stars of the team. And he kept coming to my class wearing lipstick and pearl earrings and a necklace. And I said, this guy is trying to look like a woman. Now, I have no idea whether I assume he was not trying to be a transsexual. He was trying to change his sex from man to woman. He's just looking like he was a woman, wearing a woman's clothes in our culture. So I told the coach, and the next day, the young man was in my class looking like a young man because the coach said, I'm going to kick your rear end off the team if you keep doing that. So, God, those were the days. Now, of course, this would also include transsexuality as well as the clothing, transvestism. Transvestism is when a man wears a woman's clothes and vice versa. Transsexuality is when a man actually goes through surgical operations in order to change his sex. They probably didn't have that back then, not only because they were more civilized, but also because they didn't have the medical technology. Adam Clark makes an interesting comment about this changing of dress. It certainly cannot mean a simple change in dress whereby the men might pass for women and vice versa. This would have been impossible in those countries where the dress of the sexes had but little to distinguish it and where every man wore a long beard. Well, if Clark is right about that, then what exactly is the law talking about? If you can't change clothes to show, to exhibit that you're a member of the opposite sex, then what is the verse prohibiting? It's not transsexuality. They didn't have the technology. Well, I suspect that even though it might not be simple to change the dress, that you could change enough clothes to where it would show up sooner or later that you were wearing a woman's dress if you were a man, a woman's clothing, not to mention the makeup and the jewelry. All right, what is the purpose of this law? Quote, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the adoption of the habiliments, that's an old-fashioned English word that means clothes, the adoption of the habiliments of the one sex by the other is an outrage on decency, obliterates the distinctions of nature by fostering softness and effeminacy in the man, impudence and boldness in the woman, as well as levity and hypocrisy in both. Oh, those were the days when you could say things like that and not be accused of all kinds of horrible crimes by the culture. We go now to Deuteronomy 22, verses 6 and 7. If you happen to come upon a bird's nest along the way in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, and the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall certainly let the mother go. But the young you may take for yourself, in order that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. Why should the Israelite let the mother go? Here's some options as to why. Option number one, to preserve the species of bird. Gil Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown all mentioned this possibility. The mother bird could lay more eggs, so you let the mother go. You want to preserve that species of eggs. And that's very similar to modern hunting laws like here in South Carolina. There are deer hunting laws that prohibited the shooting of does, except in very limited times, so that the deer are not totally wiped out. Now, the other deer can be shot, because otherwise they'll overrun the countryside and destroy your cars when you hit them and stare at you. When you go outside, they just look at you, and then they run. There's lots of them, lots and lots of deer. So it's all right to shoot the deer, but you don't shoot the mother, because now you're talking about you could kill the whole, you won't just protect the overspreading of the species, you might actually extinguish the species, so you got to take care of the mother. That's object number one. Object number two, letting the mother go is an object lesson to show that cruelty to a mother animal is evil, and cruelty in general is evil. Jai Gill says that the mother should not be afflicted by the sight of her young being taken, and that this compassion toward the mother bird would then be used as an object lesson for the Israelites, that they should always be merciful. Gill says this, quote, "The intention of this law is to teach humanity, compassion, and pity in men to one another, and to forbid cruelty, covetousness, and such like vices, as also to instruct in the doctrine of providence, which has a respect to birds, and our Lord may be thought to have this law in view." Of course, remember he said, the birds of the field don't worry about their food. Luke 12:6, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 cents? Yet not one of them is forgotten before God." So if God cares about the sparrows, a fortiori, he cares about human beings. Well, that's reasonable. Adam Clark, again, going along with this idea that the mother bird must be shown compassion, says that a mother would have always experienced freedom, and now she would know captivity along with her young. But if the young are taken into captivity, that's all they would ever know, and it wouldn't bother them so much. But a mother, she knew freedom, and now she's captive. So that would be cruel to her. Well, I think this is very ingenious, but I really think between those two options, object lesson against cruelty, option number two, or option number one, to preserve the species of the bird, I think preserving the species of the bird is what the law has in mind, although I can't prove it. So I give you both options for your consideration. Notice that if you let the mother go, you prolong your days. Well, that's just like another promise. Remember the commandments, one of the Ten Commandments, honor your parents so that it will go well with you and that you will live long in the land. Well, here's another promise that you will live long if you let the mother go. Whoa, such a simple little thing, and you can prolong your days. Well, it could be the object lesson here is to show respect to parents. Honor your mother and father. Well, here's a situation where a young bird has a mother, and that mother is honored by not being captured along with a young bird. Now, I think that's a stretch. I didn't write down in my notes who came up with that idea, but that's kind of a stretch. I think the simplest answer to this somewhat enigmatic verse is to say we want to preserve the species of the mother. We go now to Deuteronomy 22:8. When you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, so that you will not bring blood guilt on your house if anyone falls from it. Now, a parapet is a railing around a flat roof. The houses back then were flat, of course. And if you didn't put a railing around it, somebody sooner or later is going to fall off and probably get injured or killed. Now, this is similar to our occupational health and safety laws. Any contractor built a house like that today, or a homeowner that had a house like that, would be guilty of negligence in case somebody got hurt because of it. So that's a reasonable law. I'm going to tell a little story about that now. In my hometown, there was the house of Bill Pinckney and the original Drifters. You might remember him under the boardwalk up on the roof. Worldwide, world-famous original Drifters. And you look at that house, and he had two upstairs doors that used to open up on a balcony. Well, he removed the balcony, but the doors were still there. And I thought to myself, I hope he keeps those doors locked, because if somebody's visiting him and opens the door, he's going to step right out. He could fall 2 stories to his death or to his injury. And I would suppose that that would be a negligent suit waiting to happen. It never happened. Bill Pinckney's dead now, but he never got sued for something like that. We go now to Deuteronomy 22:9-11. You shall not sow your vineyard with two kinds of seed, or all the produce of the seed which you have sown in the increase of the vineyard will become defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a material mixed of wool and linen together. Now, these three verses are about three different kinds of illegal mixtures, different seeds mixed. That's a no-no. Number one. Number two, different animals plowing a field. That's a no-no. Number three, different material mixed of wool and linen. That's a no-no. Now, I will just say that I'm convinced that all three of these instances are examples to illustrate the principle of separation. You separate things that are different, just like the purpose of the law was to separate things that are different, namely sinful human beings and a holy God. The whole idea of this was to inculcate into the Israelites the idea of separation. There are distinctions to be made between the holy and the unholy. I don't think there was anything inherently evil about sowing your vineyard with two kinds of seed, or plowing with an ox and a donkey together, or wearing material mixed with wool and linen. There's just nothing immoral about that on the surface of it. Let's start with the prohibition against two kinds of seed in a vineyard. This is a repetition of the law in Leviticus 19:19. You are to keep my statutes. You shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. Actually, the three mixtures there are repeated from Leviticus 19:19. Now, let's look at some options as to why these mixtures are prohibited. We'll start with the seeds. This is what Clark says. It was probably forbidden to prevent excitements to such unnatural lust as those condemned in the preceding chapter, referring to preceding chapter to Leviticus 19, namely Leviticus 18, 22, and 23, which referred to homosexuality and bestiality. Not really, Adam Clark. You really think that not planting two kinds of seed in a garden or in a field is going to keep people from having homosexual lust? Really? I really don't see the connection. In fact, I think that's absolute nonsense. So let's look at option number two. This is from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Other idolatrous religions mix these things, different kinds of seeds in their fields. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, quote, ancient Zabeans, or fire worshippers, who sowed different seeds, accompanying the act with magical rites and invocations. I usually think that these weird laws is generally to keep the Israelites away from their pagan neighbors, and the pagan neighbors did weird things, and so the law said don't do those weird things. And since we don't know what those weird things are, we think it's weird because we judge according to our culture. But that's the safe answer right there. There's pagan religions were mixing the two kinds of seeds. Here's option number three, Adam Clark. Mingling seeds is injurious to flowers and grains. Now, I have trouble with that because organic farmers do that sort of thing all the time. They plant plants together that complement each other. However, there are some times when mixing different kinds of seeds can actually be inimical to agriculture. Here's a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who's quoting another gentleman named Whitlaw. Quote, if the various genera of the natural order Gramineae, which includes the grains and the grasses, should be sown in the same field and flower at the same time so that the pollen of the two flowers mix, a spurious seed will be the consequence, called by the farmers chess. It is always inferior and unlike either of the two grains that produced it in size, flavor, and nutritious principles. Independently of contributing to disease the soil, they never fail to produce the same in animals and meat that feed on them. So you can eat chess, get sick, your animals eat it and get sick, and your crops don't grow. Well, the one problem I got with this is why would there be a prohibition against something that would not be done anyway because farmers don't want to mess up their crops. So that's the problem I have with that. There's an example of this. Heirloom tomatoes, which are non-hybridized tomatoes, pure tomatoes, they taste better and more nutritious than those that have been planted with other kinds of tomatoes and had their seeds mixed. Well, even if Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is correct in saying that mixing seeds has an agricultural reason behind it, the prohibition of such had an agricultural reason behind it, that still doesn't explain the other two prohibitions. Don't plow with two different animals and don't wear clothes made of two different threads. So I really don't think that Jameson Fawcett is right about this. Option number four, object lesson against syncretism. I've already mentioned this, and I think this is one of the two best answers. It's either an object lesson against mixing things, i.e. holy things with unholy things, i.e. sin with sinful people with God. That's option number four. And option number two was other idolatrous religions did these mixings, and so the Israelites shouldn't do them. So those are the two of my favorite solutions. Let's look at how not mixing threads and seed and farm and plowing animals avoids syncretism. This is from a gentleman named Tony Warren from the internet. It is the same reason God prohibited Israel from eating shellfish or pigs, which he calls an abomination. Not to illustrate that shrimp and pork were unhealthy foods, but rather the law illustrated in these ceremonial precepts the symbolism of the spiritual differences between unclean and clean people. It signified the God-breathed principle of separation, purity, and distinction. By God making this a distinction between beasts considered clean and could be eaten, and beasts considered unclean and not be eaten, he was pointing to the separation of God's people from the Gentile unbelievers. The threads that could not be mixed with other diverse threads pointed to that same separation. Likewise, the donkey that could not work yoke together with the ox and the diverse seeds, it could not be planted in a field together. It was all to signify something infinitely more important than dietary, labor, and clothing restrictions. These laws regulating separation of animals, seeds, and threads were instituted by God as signs or parallel demonstrations to highlight the issue of keeping the children of Israel separate from the corruption of non-believers and to avoid syncretism. That is a perfect quote. I love that quote, and I think that's the answer. Now, the seed that was not supposed to be mixed probably refers to grain seeds like wheat and barley, different kinds of grain seed, not trees, because we see in Luke 13:6, Jesus gave a parable where seeds were mixed. He began telling this parable, a man had a fig tree which had been planted in his vineyard. Well, there's grapes for the vineyard and figs in the fig tree, and the fig tree was planted right in the vineyard. A direct violation of the law here in Deuteronomy 22, if we take the prohibition against mixing seeds as to refer to any kind of seeds, not just grain seeds. Now, of course, the man in the parable could have been breaking the law, but Jesus didn't point it out, so you would tend to think the man was not doing anything illegal, or Jesus would have said something about it. But at either rate, whatever it meant, it doesn't apply to us today, and all we need to remember is the idea of holiness, separation. In a vineyard, of course, how do you plant grain in a vineyard, a fig tree in a vineyard? You plant it between the rows of the vines. Now, an ox and a donkey were not supposed to plow together, according to verse 10. John, here's some options as to why that is. I've already said the reason is it's just an object lesson for separation and holiness. But let's look at some options other commentators have come up with. Option number one, to keep from gendering, that means producing, hybrid cattle as really, an ox and a donkey can breed together? I don't think so. I think that's not a reasonable solution. Option number two, to show mercy to the ass. The ass is not as strong as the ox, and so the ass would be exhausted plowing with an ox. This is John Gill's solution. He's worried about that poor ass. And again, anytime, he must have a tender spot for animals. Anytime he sees an animal being benefited by the law, he assumes the law is trying to stop cruelty to that animal. Option number three, this is from John Gill, to show that a clean ox and an unclean donkey should not be mixed together, separating the clean and the unclean. That's actually not unreasonable. Option number four, Adam Clark says that an ox and a donkey cannot profitably and comfortably pull together. Jameson Fawcett and Brown backs that up, and he says this. This is a great quote here. An ox and an ass, being of different species and of very different characters, cannot associate comfortably nor unite cheerfully in drawing a plow or a wagon. The ass being much smaller and his step shorter, there would be an unequal and irregular draft. Besides, the ass, from feeding on coarse and poisonous weeds, has a fetid breath, which its yoke fellow seeks to avoid, not only as poisonous and offensive, but producing leanness, or if long continued, death. And hence, it has been observed always to hold away its head from the ass and to pull only with one shoulder. So, this is great. The reason that oxes and asses don't pull together is because the ox is scared of bad breath in the ass. And that bad breath might kill him or hurt him. I've often wondered why one of the major political parties in America, I won't mention which one, uses a donkey, an ass, for its symbol. Why would you do that? Maybe there's some deep symbolic reasoning behind this. I really don't think that this is the reason why an ox and a donkey are not put together, an ox and an ass, is because it seems to me that a farmer would have a natural incentive not to do it anyway, so why would the law forbid something that nobody would want to do? Option number five, to make a moral object lesson. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that this may or may not have been the case, but this is an idea that maybe it was being used as an object lesson, and I think it was, to show separation from different kinds. Separation, separation, separation. What's the definition of holiness? Separation. Separation from the world. Supporting this idea that Deuteronomy is using this idea of separating an ox and a donkey as referring to a moral object lesson for holiness, Paul actually used it as an object lesson for holiness in 2 Corinthians 6:14. Do not be mismatched with unbelievers, for what partnership is there between righteousness and lawlessness? Or what fellowship does light have with darkness? And mismatched in the King James is unequally yoked, just like an ox and an ass would be unequally yoked, because the ox is big and the ass is small. So Paul used it. Now, of course, he was being metaphorical about it, I'm sure. Now let's talk about the mixed threads in a garment. Zephaniah 1:8 says this, that it will come about on the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes, the king's sons, and all who clothe themselves with foreign garments. Well, I don't know if foreign garments mixed wool and linen. I have no proof of that. Here's a couple of possible reasons why the prohibition against mixed threads in a piece of clothing. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that weaving wool and linen was a favorite superstition of ancient idolaters. If that's true, then it's obvious the Israelites should not do it for the obvious reasons. And again, you got the moral object lesson of separating different things from each other to reinforce the idea of holiness. We now go to Deuteronomy 22, verse 12. You shall make yourself tassels on the four corners of your garment with which you cover yourself. Now, these tassels are more fully described in Numbers 15, 38. Speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tassel of each corner a cord of blue. Now, notice it's the tassels are not blue. It's the cord that ties the tassel to the four corners of the garments that are blue. The cords are blue, not the tassels. What's the point of the blue? Well, it makes the tassels conspicuous when you see the cord of blue running down to the tassels. Now, the next question is what is the point of tassels? Well, in my opinion, there was nothing particularly symbolic about tassels in keeping the law, but it became symbolic because they were told to do it, and because they were told to do it, this was associated with God's commands, with keeping the law, and so pretty soon it got ingrained in their psyche that you see the tassels, that reminds them of the law and how they should keep it. The NIV Study Bible says that as one walked, the tassels would swish, thus serving as memory prods. Okay. Now, this idea that the tassels were made to be a symbol of the law and were not inherently a symbol is backed up by what Adam Clark says, quote, that there was any analogy between a fringe, a tassel, and a precept, it would be bold to assert. But when a thing is appointed to represent another, no matter how different, that first object becomes the regular representative or sign of the other. And so God made this symbol. At any rate, by the time you get to the Pharisees in the New Testament, those tassels stood for keeping the law. Actually, they're pharisaical additions to the law. Matthew 23:5, but they do all their deeds to be noticed by men, for they broaden their phylacteries and lengthen the tassels of their garments, so everybody could see how they kept the law. John Gill talks about the issue of who was to wear these tassels in Numbers 15:38. It says the sons of Israel were to wear the tassels, and that would be the priests, the Levites, the proselytes, freed servants, freed slaves. But who wasn't to wear them? That would be women and children and Gentiles. I think that's probably true. One other minor note here, Jameson Fawcett Brown says that some eminent interpreters say that the tassels are not meant for the garments of an Israelite man, but rather for the coverlet of his bed, so that when he goes to sleep, he sees those tassels and he thinks, I've got to keep the law. I don't know about that. I'll just take the majority view that the tassels go on the garments. We go now to Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 through 19. If a man marries a woman, has sexual relations with her, and comes to hate her, and accuses her of shameful conduct, and gives her a bad name, saying, I married this woman and was intimate with her, but I didn't find any evidence of her virginity, the young woman's father and mother will take the evidence of her virginity and bring it to the city elders at the gate. The young woman's father will say to the elders, I gave my daughter to this man as a wife, but he hates her. He has accused her of shameful conduct, saying, I didn't find any evidence of your daughter's virginity, but here is the evidence of my daughter's virginity. They will spread out the cloth before the city elders. Then the elders of that city will take the man and punish him. They will also fine him 100 silver shekels and give them to the young woman's father, because that man gave an Israelite virgin a bad name. She will remain his wife. He cannot divorce her as long as he lives. Now, this is one more example of how women are protected by the law. There are lots of examples in the law about how women were protected. And here a woman is protected against a hateful husband who accuses her of something naughty that she didn't do. Well, there's actually some options as to why he hates her. Option number one, John Gill mentions this. He decides that he doesn't like her personality or behavior after they get married, so then he pretends she wasn't a virgin when they got married. He creates a scam, in other words, to get out of the marriage. I don't think that's what's being referred to, but it could happen. Option number two, she really wasn't a virgin. And so he accuses her of that shameful conduct, i.e. being a non-virgin when she got married. She had sex. She fornicated with somebody before she married the man. So he accuses her of that shameful conduct of not being a virgin. Or it could be she was a virgin, but when the man went into her, he wasn't pleased with the sex he was getting from her. And so he decides to hate her because of it. Well, I think the most practical idea of what that shameful conduct is, most probable idea, is that the shameful conduct is talking about premarital sex, fornication, where she lost her virginity before she got married, thus defrauding the husband. So the shameful conduct would be that which occurred before the marriage, explaining why she wasn't a virgin, as opposed to something that happened after the marriage. She didn't cook the boiled eggs right or whatever. Now, what is this evidence that is shown to the elders of the city at the gate to prove that the woman was a virgin? It was a blood-stained cloth or garment, as the NIV Study Bible says. And John Gill explains how this garment would come to be in the possession of the father. The blood-stained cloth or garment, it doesn't have to be bedclothes, it could be the woman's nightclothes, nightgown. It was given by the woman to her parents for safekeeping. Now here's how Gill goes through the process more thoroughly with this quote. Two persons, called the friends of the bride and bridegroom, went first into their bedchamber and thoroughly examined the bed, whether there was anything relating to the sign of virginity. And they stood all night keeping watch with great joy and cheerfulness, as if they had been the guards of a king and queen. Their business was, when the bridegroom and bride came out, to rush in immediately and examine all things again. And knowing and owning the former linen sheets in which they had lain, took them and delivered them to the mother. So they went in before they had sex, looked, the sheets are clean. They go in after they had sex. Oh, there's blood on the sheets, therefore she must have been a virgin, because virgins generally bleed the first time. Now, I have a question here. I've always had this question. Couldn't the evidence be easily faked? Let's say the woman has no evidence of her virginity, but she wants to nail the man. Well, let's say that she was not a virgin and the man accuses her and she says, well, I'm going to defend myself. And so she just gets some blood somewhere, puts it on cloth, and hands it to the elders. Seems like that evidence could be easily faked. I don't know what the answer to that is. Another problem is it true that all virgins bleed? What happens if the woman was a virgin and she didn't bleed? Now she doesn't have any proof to protect her. So either way, she could either get a fake cloth, bloody cloth, to falsely show that she was a virgin, or she would not have a truly bloody cloth to prove that she actually was a virgin. And there were great consequences from this. Somebody could get executed for not being a virgin. Her husband might despise her if he thought she was a virgin when she actually was. Well, I'm sure they would have to be very carefully, judicially, to guard against such unfortunate situations as the virgin faking the cloth. But as far as the virgin not having evidence because not all virgins bleed, I think that they most probably did. Because, for one thing, they didn't go to the gynecologist before they got married, and the gynecologist would break her hymen so she wouldn't bleed when she had sex the first time. And I think most girls back then didn't ride horses and do the sort of things that modern girls do that breaks the hymen while they're still a virgin, which would keep them from bleeding on their wedding night. So I suspect that most virgins would bleed. Now, why does the father take the bloody cloth? He would get it from his wife, the mother, and take it to the gate, because the father is the girl's protector, of course. The girl is protected first by the father and then by the husband. Now, this garment is spread publicly before the judges there. That's a little squeamish. It makes a Western person a little squeamish here. But there were no squeamish ideas of Western decorum in the ancient Near East. They did it because they needed the evidence. The man who falsely accused his young wife of not being a virgin was punished. Verse 18, John Gill says he was punished with blows, not just words, but blows. They beat up on him. I don't know how he knows that. The NASB has chastised him. He's also fined 100 silver shekels. That could be the punishment was merely 100 silver shekels with no beating, no chastising, no verbal chastising, but just pay up 100 shekels. Now, that was a heavy fine, as the NIV Study Bible said. That may have been twice the average bride price. We'll see as we get on later in this chapter that a bride price is probably around 50 shekels. This is double. It would be a strong disincentive to hinder a husband from defaming his wife of being sexually immoral before she married him. Now, there was another punishment that this man who falsely accused his wife of sexual immorality, he could never divorce her. That was it. He was stuck with her. He couldn't put her away as long as he lives. Now, that's important because now the woman has got support all of her life. The law militated against easy divorce, as the NIV Study Bible said. I mean, you know, if you knew you could never divorce your wife, never. I mean, what if she committed adultery? Too bad, you can't divorce her. And of course, that's what he was trying to do when he brought the false suit to start with. Now, this is a question I ask myself. Well, okay, so now they're forced to be married for the rest of their life. Well, wouldn't that make the husband-wife relationship be somewhat awful? He's married her because he has to be married to her because of the law. Where's the romance in that? Well, this is a law. Law cannot make people righteous. It can only protect innocent people from getting screwed financially, basically. But it's not going to make people love one another, and it takes bad situations and takes the lesser of two bad situations. Modern law does the same thing. Law is only rough justice. Once you have law, you have civilization, but there's a lot of stuff beyond civilization that would be nice to have. For example, a loving husband and a loving wife, but the law can't deal with that. It's not capable of doing that. We go now to Deuteronomy 22, verses 20 and 21. But if this charge is true, that the girl was not found a virgin, then they shall bring out the girl to the doorway of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death because she has committed an act of folly in Israel by playing the harlot in her father's house. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. Playing the harlot in her father's house means she was having premarital sex while she was still under her father's protection. It doesn't necessarily mean that she did the act in the house. Now, why was she stoned to death in front of the father's house? Because that was a greater disgrace than just being stoned at a public place. It emphasizes that the daughter dishonored the father, and that'd be a terrible thing for the daughter to dishonor her father. Even in modern times, that'd be a terrible thing to dishonor your father, a girl, to do that. But back then, it was really something bad. So this is a horrible punishment. Of course, the deterrent effect of the law is quite pronounced here. The odds are there's very few girls that are going to have sex and then get married and lie about it to their new husband. Very few. She would be stoned to death for adultery. That's the typical punishment for adultery. Now, there's a special case if the daughter of a priest committed adultery. She got burnt up. Leviticus 21:9. If a priest daughter defiles herself by promiscuity, she defiles her father. She must be burned up. That's because priest or with rank comes its responsibilities, and a priest's daughter has more responsibility than an average person. So she commits adultery. Ooh, she's messing with God's priest who are trying to keep everything holy, and so she has a more severe punishment. Here's another situation where adultery is punished by death, Leviticus 20:10. If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. And of course, that would be by stoning. And notice that the law is the same for the man as the woman. No double standard here. Well, we'll let the man get away with it. He's got more testosterone. It's hard for him to control his drives. But the woman, she can control herself. No. They both die. The man dies as well as the woman. And you see this in any law that has to do with sexual immorality. And, of course, the stoning purges the evil because it kills the woman and she's gone. Kills the fornicating woman who has defiled her marriage. And, by the way, we're going to see in just a minute a fornicating woman who has not defiled her marriage. She's single. She's not betrothed or married to anybody. She actually doesn't get stoned. But, boy, when you fornicate and mess up your marriage is serious business, and the law is more serious, and you got stoned for that. And you will have the evil purged from you. Deuteronomy always talks about purging evil. I'm going to run through several examples to show you that. Deuteronomy 17:17 says idolaters are to be stoned to death and the evil purged from Israel. Deuteronomy 19:19, perjurers were to be stoned to death to purge the evil from Israel. Deuteronomy 21:21, rebellious sons were to be purged, but stoned to death in order to purge evil from Israel. Deuteronomy 13:5, false prophets and false dreamers of dreams were to be stoned to death in order to purge the evil, or just put to death, it says, in order to purge the evil from among you. In Deuteronomy 24:7, a kidnapper is to be killed in order to purge the evil from Israel. So this idea of keeping Israel holy with capital punishment was a big, big idea. It was necessary back then. Remember, God's law, the Old Covenant law, was regulating people who were not saved. They were basically a bunch of rebellious idolaters and fornicators, and they were not good people. We tend to think, oh, that's God's chosen people, so therefore they were saints. No, they were not. The New Testament at least had the Holy Spirit internally restraining Christians from doing evil. that in addition to the laws of Christ, and so you don't need the Old Testament law anymore, and the laws of Christ are generally more moderate.
I say they're more moderate. The punishments were more moderate, but the requirements were more strict.
In order for the New Testament law to operate, it could operate more strictly, actually. Instead of anger, it could be, instead of murder, the Old Testament law says no murder, the New Testament law said no anger. It's because the Holy Spirit was there to help people keep these more strict commands of Jesus. We go now to Deuteronomy 22:22. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die, the man who lay with the woman and the woman. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Now this is the general law against adultery. It's a repeat of the law in Leviticus. Leviticus 20:10 says this: if there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. Notice that both the man and the woman are stoned. There's no double standard there. The man suffers just like the woman. And again, this is a married situation. The woman is married, and the man is messed. Whether he's single or married doesn't make any difference. He's messed with a marriage, and you mess with a marriage under the Old Testament law, you are toast. We go now to Deuteronomy 22:23-24. If there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out of the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. Now this is a situation where a virgin is engaged, betrothed, and we'll see that engagement is just as serious as marriage. You mess with the marriage, you die. You notice in verse 24, both of them are stoned. So we got a married woman in verse 22. Somebody messes with that marriage adulterously, boom. They both killed. Now here we got a virgin who is betrothed but not married. Doesn't matter. Bang. And notice it says in verse 24, the man has violated his neighbor's wife. Even though she was only betrothed or engaged, she's called a wife here. That shows that you're betrothed. You're looked on just like you're a wife. And you have sex with somebody that's betrothed. Bye-bye. Now, all of this is for marriage, verse 22, 23, and 24, for violated marriages. But now, what about single people who fornicated? Penalty was actually less than death. We see in Leviticus 19:20, if a man has sexual intercourse with a woman who is a slave designated for another man, designated for but not married to or betrothed to, but she has not been redeemed or given her freedom, there must be punishment. They are not to be put to death because she has not been freed. In other words, the man has not messed with a marriage. He's punished. Doesn't say what right here, but he is punished. Well, it says there must be punishment, so the woman will be punished too, I presume. But they're not to be put to death because no marriage has been messed with. Deuteronomy 22:28-29, which we're going to get to in just a minute. If a man finds a girl who is a virgin who is not engaged, she's single, and seizes her and lies with her, and they're discovered. Now, of course, the question there, it might be rape, might not be rape, could be consensual sex. People debate it, but let's assume it. Just to say right now, I think it is rape, but let's just say it's not. And if a man finds a girl who's a virgin, he seizes her and lies with her, and they're discovered. So let's say it's consensual sex, but neither one of them are messing with a marriage or a betrothal. Then the man who lay with her shall give the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall become his wife. Because he has violated her, he cannot divorce her all his days. So the man is not put to death. So just in general, married people having sex, having adultery, having sex with somebody that's not their wife or their fiance or their husband, they die. But if they're single people, you're punished, but it's not as bad. Now, and that's interesting because that's just like social attitudes today. Many non-Christians think it's okay to sow wild oats when they're single, but once they get married, oh, I got to shape up. I can't commit adultery. That would be wrong. All right, verse 24, it says that the girl shall be stoned to death because she did not cry out in the city. Now, assuming the girl's in the city and she's being raped, she would cry out and somebody would hear it. But if she didn't cry out, that means she's enjoying what she's doing. She's not protesting, so she's committing adultery. Fornication, actually. She's not married. And I think I just said that verses 23 and 24 might refer to a rape. Wrong. Verses, that's Deuteronomy 25:26-27 that refers to a rape. So my bad on that. This is talking about single people who engage in sex voluntarily because she did not cry out in the city. Now, of course, there is the possibility they could have been in the country, and there's no point in crying out in the country, in which case it could be voluntary or it could be rape, either way. But in the normal case here, I think this is talking about in general, fornicating single people are going to be
fornicating engaged people are going to suffer the death penalty. That's easy to establish. Now, notice that this adultery is occurring in the city. Usually a woman in the city would not be in the city. She would be in her father's home, not wandering around in a city where she could be picked up or where she could be subject to temptation. As John Gill says, being there also makes against her, being in the city also makes against her. Since, being betrothed to a man, she ought to have abode in her father's house till her husband fetched her home, and not to have gadded abroad in the city where she was exposed to temptation. Now, in verse 24, the fact that this girl was stoned to death because she formerly was an engaged virgin, then she has sex before she got married, it shows that sex before marriage was wrong in the Old Testament. And as a matter of fact, the New Testament shows the same thing. 1 Corinthians 7:9, but if they do not have self-control, this man and a woman who are burning with passion, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with desire. Paul assumes that you're not going to quench that burning with premarital fornication. You have to get married to quench it, because that's the only place it's legal. Now, I say that because it's amazing. I've run into two situations in my life where sincere, dedicated Christians told me that they didn't think it was anything wrong with fornicating with their girlfriends before they got married. One of them was a seminary guy, a real smart guy. And as soon as I heard that from my seminary mate, I'm thinking, yeah, and so you're banging your girl. I knew who his girlfriend was. I knew her name. I still know it. And I said, you know, don't go around telling people that it's all right to fornicate when you're not married and you got a girlfriend, for crying out loud. But, you know, people at seminary think they can figure out anything. Well, they're wrong. Fornication is porneia, sexual immorality. It's translated adultery a lot in the New Testament. It means any kind of sexual immorality. And sexual immorality is defined as any kind of sex outside of a legal marriage. We go now to Deuteronomy 22, verses 25 through 27. But if in the field the man finds a girl who is engaged, and the man forces her and lies with her. Now, this is obviously rape because it says forces her. Verses 23 and 24 is not rape because she didn't cry out. So that would be consensual. So I think some people do argue that it's rape, but I think it's consensual. But here in verses 25 through 27, it says the man forces her and lies with her. That sounds like rape to me. Although John Gill says, is this rape or is this adultery? I think the Holman Christian Study Bible says the man seizes her and lies with her. Well, you know, you could interpret that as, you know, he just takes her in his arms passionately and she passionately agrees. So it's not rape. Well, I don't care whether it's rape or not. The main issue is the man who does this, who has sex with a girl who's engaged, whether it's rape or whether it's consensual, he dies, because that betrothal is just like a marriage. When he found her in the field, verse 27, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. And so we assume that even though she cried out, the crying out shows that it was rape, because she's crying out for help. She couldn't get it because she's in the country. But then there's an evidentiary problem because of that. If there was no one to save her, there was also no one to hear her cry out. So how is she going to prove that she cried out? There's nobody there to witness except the rapist. Well, the judges are going to have to rely on the testimony of the man and the woman and do the best they can to see who's credible and who's not credible in that situation. Now, in this case of forced rape, of course, the girl is not executed. There was no sin of the girl worthy of death, even though she was engaged. It was against her will, and so she doesn't die. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. In other words, a murder victim is not guilty, and neither is a rape victim. Yeah, that's easy law there. Go to Deuteronomy 22, verses 28 and 29. If a man finds a girl who is a virgin who is not engaged, this is a single girl, and seizes her and lies with her, and they are discovered, then the man who lay with her shall give to the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall become his wife, because he has violated her. He cannot divorce her all his days. Again, we got the same problem. This seizing her, is this rape or is it consensual? I'm assuming it's rape. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's rape or seduction. The point is, the virgin was not engaged, so a marriage was not messed with. And so, therefore, the man who did that, he's punished, but he's not executed because he didn't mess up a marriage. The way he's punished is, he's got to pay the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, which is probably somewhere around the typical bride price that had to be paid. Now, if this virgin girl had been betrothed, the man could not get away with having to pay 50 shekels of silver. He had to pay with his life. He had to die. Why the difference? This is my speculation. The law cannot order a rapist of a betrothed girl to marry the rapist. She's already engaged to be married to somebody else.
And besides, she didn't need the rapist to support her because her betrothed fiancé was going to support her for the rest of her life. But now if she's single, she's going to be humbled, disgraced in the eyes of the community. Who's going to want to marry her? Oh, she's not a virgin anymore. I'm not going to marry her. So who's going to marry her? Well, the law says the rapist is going to marry her. That's who's going to marry her. And he's going to pay for it, too. Now, this 50 shekels of silver, it might have been the average bride price a husband in ordinary circumstances must pay, but that bride price actually probably varied with different economic statuses of different brides, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, this forced marriage here, it sounds terrible, but there's probably an implied condition. The father and the daughter would both agree to the marriage. In other words, the father and daughter could force the rapist to marry the girl, but only if they wanted to. They didn't have to. The father and the daughter might say, this guy is a nasty rapist. But it could be the girl was innocent, she was a virgin, and the guy got carried away and says, I want you. No, 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 no. And the guy says, well, you know, when a girl says no, she really means yes. And he keeps going, and he violates her against her will. But she still basically loves him, and he loves her, and so he says, okay, I'll go ahead and marry her. But if he's somebody that just takes her randomly and rapes her, I can imagine why the wife would say, no, I just prefer, it's a bad situation, but I prefer not to be married to this guy. We go now to Deuteronomy 22:30, and we'll finish up chapter 22. A man shall not take his father's wife so that he will not uncover his father's skirt. Well, first of all, that metaphor there is an archaic expression, uncover his father's skirt, which means to dishonor his father's bed, as the NIV translation translates it. You dishonor your father when you take your father's wife. Now, there's three situations when you could do that. Your father could be dead, he could be divorced, or he could still be alive. That would really be bad if you did it when he was alive. Taking your father's wife, and of course your father's wife would not be your mother, but that would be a second wife, so she would be your stepmother. Now, the penalty for this, as we see in Deuteronomy 27:20, is serious. Cursed is he who lies with his father's wife, because he has uncovered his father's skirt. And all the people shall say, amen. I'm using the NASB translation because it keeps that idiom in there, uncovering the father's skirt. You're cursed. Now, the opposite of uncovering your skirt is spreading your skirt over you, and that was the way that you proposed marriage. Like in Ezekiel 16:8, this is God speaking of Israel, his wife. Then I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love. So I spread my skirt over you. In other words, you were old enough to get married. So I spread my skirt over you. There's the metaphor. It means, I want you to marry me. I covered your nakedness. I imagine that the metaphor here, uncovering your father's skirt, if you're lying in bed and you got a nightgown on, the guy has some kind of a gown on, and he puts it over his wife to keep her warm, well, that shows he's married to her. Then a son goes in there and jerks that skirt off. I'm speaking very literally here. Takes that skirt off. That means the wife is exposed. He takes the skirt off of the wife so then he can have sex with the wife. Well, that's pretty shameful. So that's where the metaphor comes from. Spreading one's garment over a woman was a common request for marriage and is still the practice in some parts of the Middle East today, as the NIV Study Bible says. Of course, the famous example of this is Ruth 3:9. He, that's Boaz, said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. Now, of course, the way we nasty Westerners read that, oh, God, I even see they're lying down there, and she wants to sleep down there, and she wants him to put his covering, his blanket over her so they can have sex. No, that's not what it was. It was just her way of saying, will you marry me? Which is kind of interesting because you normally don't think of ancient women asking men to marry them. But she did, basically, when she said, spread your covering over me. Now, this idea of not dishonoring your father's wife by having sex with your... This idea of not dishonoring your father by having sex with your father's wife is probably illustrated in the story of Adonijah and Bathsheba and Solomon. This is in 1 Kings 2, 13-25. I'll summarize it. David was married to Bathsheba, and David had a concubine named Abishag. David also had a son called Solomon and another son called Adonijah. Solomon and Adonijah were half-brothers. And so Adonijah goes to David's wife Bathsheba and says, I would like David's concubine Abishag. So basically he was saying, I want to have sex with my father's concubine, which is the same thing as your father's wife. Ooh, that's bad business. And David did not appreciate it. He said, well, guess what? Adonijah just signed his death warrant, and then he executed him. So serious business to talk about having sex with your father's
women.
Remember, Reuben did that to Bilhah, who was his father's, Jacob's, concubine. It was Rachel's handmaiden, but she basically belonged to Jacob. And then Reuben had sex with Bilhah and lost his firstborn inheritance, the double portion, because of his sin. Now, I mentioned earlier that this dishonoring your father's bed by having your father's wife, what if he was dead? Well, you think, well, what's so wrong with that? Well, what if he's divorced? If he was alive, that would definitely be a dishonoring of him, and that's obvious. That's a bad thing. But if he's dead or divorced, it's not so clear. In my opinion, I don't think you ought to do that either. I don't think they would allow that back then in the Old Testament. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy 22. In Deuteronomy 23, our next chapter, we will look at how Israelites could be excluded from the assembly, and then we'll look at some more miscellaneous laws. Hope to see you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.